You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Hi, I'm Ed Lynn, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show, yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Ed Lynn. He's the author of The Dead Can't Make a Living. Ed, how are you?
I'm doing good and somewhat making a living.
Yeah, well, you're not dead yet.
Not yet.
Right. It's by the way, I got to say, with your press materials, I love that you're a journalist in training and an all-around stand-up kind of guy. And I got to say, that is the best opening line of a bio that I've ever read in my life.
Journalist by trade.
Journalist by trade. Oh, wait, it says journal. Did they get it right on your? No, it says training.
In training. Oh my God.
And it says, and I got your advance. Oh, you better check it out because here's your advance review copy, and it says journalist by training.
Oh, journal. I guess that counts by training.
By training.
Maybe I'm
okay.
Not in training, but okay. You know, I guess.
Whew. Bolt dodged a bullet there. Wait. What do you cover as a journalist? Do you still write?
You know, I recently left journalism at the end of August, but for 30 years I was in financial journalism.
Oh, okay.
And I spent the last 15 years or so writing a column about insider stock trading and institutional investing.
Very cool.
Yeah, let's make sure everyone's not asleep right now.
Oh, no, I find economics and finance like fascinating because it's how the world goes round. How did you get into that?
I went to journalism school, graduate program at Columbia. You see, as an undergrad, I had this master plan. My master plan was that I would write books, at night, but my day job, I could be a journalist, right? So yeah. I would still, kind of be flexing those same fingers, typing and everything. And I told, I was taking a couple of writing classes. And I told my professor, I was like, I got it all figured out. I was great plan. I'm going to be a journalist during the day, and then at night I'm going to write books. And he just shook his head. He's like, so many have tried. It just doesn't work. You're just going to work at your job, then you're going to be too tired to write.
Yeah.
But I did it. I wish I could tell him I did it.
Do you think part of him denying that idea like pushed you even harder to make sure you can do it?
You know, I'm definitely someone who pushes up against negative reinforcement, but I would say that I just kind of didn't really pay heed to it. I don't pay heed to warnings, essentially.
Yeah. And you're looking at a bottle of bleach and it says, do not drink. And you're like, what is this?
Sounds like a dare to me.
Rat poison. Do not consume. I'm in.
Hey, I'm not a rat.
Yeah. It's not for real. I'll be fine.
Nothing's going to happen.
How are you alive, my friend?
Oh my gosh, I've defied so many things. God. Well, as an undergrad, my major is mining engineering, but I never actually worked as an engineer.
Huh. Do you think engineering, though, kind of helped your brain with, because in the end, like, even as a writer, I used to do tech support and work in computers. But as a writer, I feel like I create the first draft, and then I just created a huge problem for myself that I need to do tech support on for another 10 drafts. I don't know if you get that.
Yeah, I mean, I do multiple drafts of stuff. But, you know, the thing is about engineering is that it's a very optimistic kind of profession because you're presented with a problem, and engineering can find five, six, seven different solutions. You just have to find like the best one. But there's always a solution to every problem.
And do you think that's different as an author?
It's kind of the same because you know, many times, I mean, I'm not a plotter. I kind of, write by the seat of my pants. So many times I paint myself into a corner and I think, oh my gosh, where am I supposed to go with this? But, inevitably there is a way out. Raymond Chandler always said that if you have no idea what to do next, have a man come in through the door with a gun. There's many other ways too, but
yeah. And as Chekhov said, you got to use that gun now. So you've thrown yourself into a hole. You're like, wow, I've been writing this love story about a marriage. Okay, now a guy comes in with a gun, and then all of a sudden, it's pure violence. this flowery romance you had going, pure violence.
See, but when he pulls the trigger, only bleach shoots out. So
then
you just ruined your suit. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So you are of Taiwanese and Chinese descent. Did you?
Yes.
Did you grow up in Taiwan or China?
I'm a native New York. I was born out in Queens, Howard Beach. My earliest memories are hearing the planes landing and taking off at JFK. But, I feel like I've been living with Taiwan my whole life, because, when I was a kid, there was still martial law in Taiwan. And the KMT, which was the martial law government at the time, they had agents in the U.S. at, like, restaurants and, like, on campuses, like cracking down on people who were advocating for independence for Taiwan or anything that was anti Chiang Kai-shek. Like your family back in Taiwan would suffer the consequences. They'd be blacklisted from jobs and work and stuff.
So you still had family in Taiwan, so you needed to be careful.
Yeah, at the time. Yeah, definitely.
Wow.
I remember we were at this Chinese restaurant in New Jersey that we'd never been to before. And I remember there was this waiter who was like, there were like these fake bushes set up in this restaurant. This waiter was like looking at us and like trying to listen in on our conversation. And he sure didn't get much out of us.
That's intense though. Did that set you up to kind of really be on guard for the rest of your life in a way? Like does that ever go away when you're watched that much and with this high stakes involved?
Well, martial law was lifted in 87, 88 after a whole lot of social disruptions on the island for quite a few years. The way I thought about it is that in the first book I really hammered on this, like the division between like Joy Division and becoming New Order. Like with Joy Division, everything's very black and white and very stark, like kind of martial beat, like that to me kind of represented martial law. And then the flowering afterwards, the democracy, being able to vote for things, that is kind of like the dancing New Order sort of phase. But they both kind of still exist. Like there's stuff from the past that comes up, especially around election time. But they like kind of coexist. Like New Order and Peter Hook now, they even though they are focused on like a lot of New Order stuff for decades, they still have to pull out the Joy Division songs because that's what really reaches people as well.
And so
I guess it never really does leave you.
Right. Ian Curris just kills himself. And then all of a sudden, what the whole world's changed and there's flowers. Apologies to Ian Curris, to his family and anyone else I've offended there.
Well, when New Order started doing their finally made to America and doing a lot of the makeup gigs that Joy Division was going to do, their equipment was robbed, like all the stuff that they used during Joy Division. And Tony Wilson, who was the head of Factory Records, told them, "Oh, darlings, it's beautiful. It's just beautiful. All the equipment's been stolen." And New Order was like, "What?"
Oh, man.
But he was a guy who could find the humor in most things.
What fascinated me, because I guess in the timeline of Joy Division, they found out that they were going to the U.S. They were really starting to break out. And that's when Ian Curtis offed himself. And part of me wonders if he couldn't deal with the idea of going that big or even going across the Atlantic. Like, he must have had some other, I just feel like he had other stuff going on, that if they didn't have that breakout, maybe he would have still been around, but then we also wouldn't have New Order and et cetera. But there's so much more involved when someone does that. It's, you can't just pin it on one thing. So,
yes, so many things. I mean, he apparently had been talking about leaving the band already.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, his epileptic fits were getting worse. And at one point, he watched from the wings as the band continued on without him, with different singers. And so that already put the idea in his head, well, they will go on without me.
Yeah.
I think, you know.
Did you watch the movie 24-Hour Party People?
I did. And I also watched the documentary Joy Division.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing. Like, Bernard Sumner says that he hypnotized, you know, Ian Curtis and got him to go into his past lives. And there's this really creepy passage where you hear Ian's voice under this hypnosis, saying that he's sitting there reading a book of laws.
Wow. You know what? I don't know if I've seen that then. Oh my God, because I would have remembered that scene. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, you got to check it out.
Yeah. I got to interview Peter Hook many years ago. The first girl that I loved, I kissed at an Echo and the Bunnymen New Order tour in 1987. And her and I kissed during Lips Like Sugar by Echo and the Bunnymen. And then we made our way to the very front, right under Hookie's bass. And we like sat there the rest of the night right under Hookie's bass we showed our love through each other as young people do through a kiss. And then after that, we basked under Hookie's bass. And I finally got to tell him that story, and that like, that felt like the whole world went full circle to me. And he was just like, "I remember that gig." And I was like, "Dude, we were right there and I was in love. And you were playing the swan song, man."
Oh my gosh. You know, I remember that tour. I didn't see it, but I saw next year when it was New Order with the Sugar Cubes and Public Image Limited.
Oh my God, I was at that tour too. Oh my God.
You were?
Yes.
I was at the East Rutherford leg.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we were. Yeah. I still lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, so they played a place called Shoreline. But that was fantastic. And nobody knew who the Sugar Cubes were. I'm like, why is nobody here? These guys are great.
Oh, man. They were forced to play while people were still coming into the arena, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah.
Yeah. No, and that was just beautiful. And what I saw PIL in 1985, and then I saw them in 87 on that. I think it was at 87, or was that 89? That might have been 89.
I think it was 89. Summer 89.
The next time I saw them was 2012, and they did most of the catalog from First Edition and Second Edition or Metal Box. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the show we saw, that tour, and the 2012 tour were the two best ones. Like, those were just off the hook. I couldn't believe that they were just doing the real slow stuff. Like, the entire song Albatross just I'm going, no way. This is like, they're playing my favorite Pill record with all the slow, long songs.
Slow motion.
Exactly. They're on tour again, Go ahead.
I remember at the end, I thought Pill was going to get to do an encore, but instead, Lydon just kept going, "Goodbye. Goodbye."
Oh, I forgot. Because it was in a seated arena, so but I had front row tickets, and so when he came over to my side of the stage, I ran up to him, and there was like guards there and stuff. They were like coming at me, and I ran up to him, and I put my hand up, and he spit in his hand, and he gave me a high five. And I got to say, that was the closest to punk rock royalty I'd ever been in my life at that point in my life. And people were like, "Dude, he spit in his hand before you like before you hit your hand," and I'm like. Like, that's an insult? Like, I'm never washing this hand again. I still haven't. I have gangrene on it, if you could see.
Wow, nice, nice.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I went to see, John Entwistle. He had a band. He put together a band in, like, the fall of 87. And, he's playing pretty relatively small clubs for a member of The Who. Uh-huh. And at the end, he just went up to the front and shook hands with everybody. And I reached up, and my finger hooked into his wrist strap, and his watch slid onto my hand as if I were trying to steal his watch. And he grabbed it back, and he like showed like the security guy. He's like, "Hey, this guy tried to steal my watch."
Oh my god!
So that's probably the last time he ever extended a hand to the audience.
Yeah.
It was an accident. I swear to God, John.
Isn't it great to have that we get that moment of closeness with our heroes, and then we scare the crap out of them so they remember us?
Yeah, I know. Don't need your heroes, but you know the heroes don't want to meet you.
That would have been crazy if you walked out with his watch and you didn't even know. Like, he didn't know and you didn't know, and you're just walking outside. And then, because when you're at those shows, there's so many bodies pushing up against you in those
there
days.
There are.
You wouldn't even think about it.
Yeah, it's so chaotic.
Yeah. Which I used to love. Now it's the last thing I ever want to do in my life. But you love it. Mm-hmm. I loved it when I was younger.
Yeah. I still try to get out, see shows, you know. Hey, Luna tonight. They sold out 3 nights in a row.
Oh, wow. Okay. Who is Luna? Do I know Luna?
Luna was the band.
I ask you like you're my wife of 40 years. What? Go ahead.
And we went to the same shows. We're practically married. Luna is the band that Dean Wareham formed after Galaxy 500.
Oh, okay. Okay. I remember Galaxy 500. Yeah. We are of the same age and time.
Huge following in New York, you know, one of these New York bands that they don't have to put out a new album. They can just show up and do shows and people will come.
Oh, it's so fascinating how regionally things were in those days too, where it's because like we used, like when I was young, we used to get the Red Hot Chili Peppers in San Francisco like all the time. You just see them at small clubs all the time. And it's just like, and all the like skate dudes and skater girls would go see them, you know, and it was just like, and they wouldn't even sell out. They would play small clubs and it's just like, it wouldn't even sell out. And then like all of a sudden they just got huge.
And oh my God.
Yeah.
I saw Nirvana on their first tour when their first album came out.
Wow.
Bleach.
Yeah.
They were opening for Tad.
Oh, no way.
They were opening for Tad. And I remember, I don't know if it's the last show at the gig, but last show of the tour, but they played Maxwell's, which held like 200, 220 people.
Yeah.
And there were probably only about 100 people were there watching.
Yeah.
And like Kurt Cobain destroyed his guitar and then kicked the drum kit apart.
Wow. And they didn't have Dave Grohl yet. They had the first drummer.
Yeah, I don't know if there's Chad Channing on the tour or not. Now I can't remember. Yeah. But they did have that guy, was it Jason Everman?
I don't know.
Second guitar during the tour, even though he didn't play on the first album.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Man, what a mind-blowing time that was, because MTV was just like garbage. It's just like if you weren't a hair band or what else was going on? It was just kind of hair band or bad synthy pop. You never get on. And then all of a sudden to see like Nirvana have a heavy rotation was just insane to even think about. That wasn't supposed to happen.
Yeah, I know. Well, MTV, apart from inane videos, it also had like an hourly update from Kurt Loder, a rather
Right.
sobering affair, always like, what?
And now, yeah, Kurt Loder. Oh my God, we are aging our my we are aging ourselves so much.
You know, but I will say that a Kurt Loder update is how I found out Husker Du broke up. And I was like, what?
Wow. Did
Oh,
you ever
yeah,
get to
that's my
see
favorite
them? I
band.
never get to
I
saw
saw
them.
them once. I saw
Yeah.
them once. They played the Ritz. I think it was October 87. And I
Wow.
remember it was 12:50 to go. Yeah. I mean,
Damn.
seeing, you know, I mean, seeing Greg Norton play It's Not Funny Anymore with his fingers was just incredible. So I was like, wow, how do you do that with your fingers, man? That sounds
Yeah.
like a pick on the album, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Insane.
Yeah.
And then you're
Yeah.
on the DC side and the East Coast side of all the punk rock shows. You must have gone to a lot of things that I would be so envious of.
Oh my God. I would go to CBGB's almost every weekend. I mean, I was just looking for that thing, you know. I just wanted to hear what was happening, you know. And at the time, like, New York was going through this kind of noise rock era. Like, bands like White Zombie were out there, were just starting. Who's that other one? Shoot, Bringing Home the Bait was their first album, and they had, oh, Live Skull,
Huh.
who recently have reunited.
Uh-huh.
And these things were just like, be like noise tantrums, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that was what got me into wearing earplugs. I hadn't worn earplugs for a while. I was like, oh man, this is, I'm not gonna be able to hear when I'm 20.
Oh, exactly. No, I just went to the doctor for my. They're like, "How's your hearing?" I'm like, "Well, my ears ring all the time," and I'm like, "But I've been to like,
Oh.
I've seen thousands of bands because I used to work like the door at
Wow.
some point, you know, where you're just like, my ears are shot
Wow.
because I did it to myself." So,
Oh my gosh. But it's worth it, you know.
I
Hey,
think it was,
I
yeah.
had a Joey Ramone moment.
Yo.
I went to see Los Lobos because they were on Sire. I think because they were on Sire, Joey Ramone was there too.
Huh.
And I ran into him by the stairs, and I said, "Joey, they didn't play La Bamba." And he goes, "They didn't?"
I took his
Is
watch.
perfect. And I took his watch. Oh, if only he wore a watch, you know.
I remember seeing the Ramones, and I just remember how much he would drool sometimes. Joey Ramone, like when he, it would just be like, I'd be like, dude, I would not want to touch that microphone after a Ramone set. It's just like there was just so much drool coming off.
Oh my gosh. Did you see him when CJ was on bass, or when
With DD and CJ, they what they
CD?
would do in
Yeah.
the Bay Area is they would come and they would do like 4 nights in a row in the 80s. And they would just play 4 nights in a row, and you'd go like two or three of them if you could. I had a friend that would go to every single one, and it's just like it was just a place almost to like you see the Ramones, and then you also see the other freaky friends that you remember from around. You know, it's
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
so were you still living in Queens at the time, and then you had the access to Manhattan? Is that why you got to like just be around all of this beauty
No,
of?
I was going to Columbia.
Oh,
I was
okay.
going to Columbia. I started at 87 through
Okay.
91. So, like, the cream of the
Oh, dude.
80s.
The so you lived up in Columbia at where the Columbia is? Yeah.
Yeah, Morningside Heights, they call it. But
Yeah.
116th Street.
Okay.
Back then, man, the train just, it was still a 24-hour system, supposedly. But man, coming from downtown to catch a train uptown, it would just take hours. And you'd get
Really?
back at like 3, 4 in the morning. Yeah, seriously.
Why would it take that long? Was it just like they were, it was just a crappy system going slow?
Yeah, it was going slow, and then you'd go from like Bowery, and then you'd hit Times Square, and they'd say, this train is going out of service.
Oh my
Wait
God.
Wait here for the next one to go up down. And like that would be like another hour and a half.
Uh-huh.
Crazy.
Wow. Yeah,
but it's not like that now, you know.
No, what's the train that goes that way? Is that the 6? No. I'm trying to remember.
Well, you know, you try to catch like maybe the F or the M or R to Times Square.
Yeah.
And then maybe the 2 uptown, but then, you know, that would be another delay.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I wish I lived in New York in those times, man.
I wish I was in the Bay Area. I wish I had seen Dead Kennedys. I never saw them. So.
Yeah, I grew up in the Bay Area, and I never saw Dead Kennedys either. I did. I mean, I talked to Jello Biafra a lot at shows. He just still shows up to everything. I haven't been in. I moved from San Francisco about 11 years ago, but I'd go see bands all the time when I still lived there. And he was always around, and he had alternative tentacles. So if bands were playing on that label, he was just having a beer with the rest of us. Sometimes talking too much.
He just had
much.
A stroke.
I know. I saw that.
Yeah.
It looked like he was doing good. He was sitting up in bed. I saw the photo with a big smile on his face. So I'm like, all right.
Yeah.
But nothing to play around with. What are we getting old?
Yes. It's okay. No, we're getting seasoned. This is a knowledge base that we have.
That's right.
Yeah, the kids don't have history.
Exactly. Kids, listen to us. I'm glad you're listening to us because you're getting a little learn on here, kids.
Yeah. You know, whenever the Avengers come out east, I always see them because love them. Penelope Houston, brilliant.
She's amazing. I don't know if you've heard her solo stuff, but her solo stuff is beautiful. Yeah. Like, she is great on so many levels. She worked at the San Francisco Public Library for a really long time. Like, she was at the library. Penelope Houston of the Avengers was a librarian. It's just like, wait, how sexy can you be, Penelope? Can you stop that? You're a librarian and you're Penelope Houston? Okay, you're killing all men in the punk rock world.
I mean, is there anything more punk rock than, you know, being a librarian?
Oh, right? God, bless her heart. Yeah, she just she just played LA too, and I missed it, and I'm really mad I missed it because she played solo, and I just when she plays solo, I've seen her have this like weird small harp one time. It was just her and a harp, I'm just like sitting there going,
oh wow.
It's like I'd rather see that than the Avengers, just because there's just it's just so much fun to see where she goes with it, you know. But now I can't even think of their big song. See, American in Me. There we go.
I love Corpus Christi. You know. Back I discovered the Pink album in college. It was actually pretty hard to find. And then I remember reading in this interview that it was a bootleg, and like she wasn't getting none of the Avengers were getting any money out of it. And I was like, oh my God, if they ever get back together, I'm gonna just buy all their stuff.
Yeah,
so every time Penelope comes out with something, you know, I pick it up. I think her solo album Bird Boys is awesome. Like, she should do a tour of that.
Oh yeah.
Start, Oh Harry Dean.
Yeah, I it's what she's done solo, I think, is just so much more expansive and beautiful. It's so great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's right. I booked her because I used to book storytelling and reading events in San Francisco, and then I had her. She would come out and do like just small. That's when she brought her little small harp. So she did like a little 10-minute set in between our whiny stories about lost love and such 20 years ago. Oh, we hurt so bad.
Oh, I'm going to be doing a reading in the Bay Area. I'm going to be in Oakland at a great good place for books. And I'm going to be in conversation with B. Vail of Research.
Oh, I love him. Oh, he's an institution of the Bay Area,
that
for sure.
Yeah, that guy is like, you know, Plymouth Rock for like genius.
Yeah. What's the date on that? So the kids know, because we're on radio up there.
Oh, okay. It's May 7th, Thursday night.
May 7th. And what's the bookstore called in Oakland?
It's called Great Good Place for Books.
Great Good Place for Books. Man, I haven't been in Oakland in like over 20 years. When I lived in San Francisco for the past like my last 12 years in San Francisco, I just never left the city. There was no reason to. It was hard to get out of my neighborhood because I'd want to go see a band in the Mission District, and I'd walk out my door, and then I'd see like my friends are in another band, and they're going, "Oh, hey, we're playing like Chemo's right up the street," and I'm like, "Well, I'm going with you guys." It's like to try to even get through those beautiful days of insanity, which now at that time of night, I'm in bed with a book, which is my new punk rock.
Oh my gosh. Have you found the Libby app? Speaking of librarians.
Oh, Libby, that's right. I've heard of it. Yes.
It's killer.
Yeah. I've been using Canopy a lot I don't know if you have Canopy there or not. You got that video streaming, which is great.
Yeah, the New York Library is like axed the Canopy license like right when the pandemic hit. It was horrible because like that would have been like awesome.
Oh, but, my God.
They recently reacquired the Canopy license.
Sweet, sweet. I still need to go to the big library in New York, which is – where is that? My friends – because I've only been in New York a few times over the past few years.
Oh, wow.
And the last time I was up there, I stayed at the YMCA at Columbus Square.
Because you were inspired by Trump singing YMCA?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was inspired by that. It had nothing to do with being inspired by my low budget. Because I love showering in a common bathroom with other naked fellas.
Yeah, but the Midtown library is called, I believe it's called the Stravos Nacharos branch. It's, man, they put in so much money in that place, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
It's like 42nd and it's a 42nd and 5th.
Yeah.
You can't miss it. It's huge.
It's pretty close.
They actually have like a cafe on the upper floors.
Wow. Yeah, I can't wait to go because I'm going to be in New York in October, and then I'll be in New York a little bit in November because that's going to be the front and back end to a longer trip elsewhere. And whenever I go to Europe, I'm always like, I gotta see friends in New York anyway. So I hang out in New York for a bit and then go back and forth.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Yeah, I can't wait to see that. The last time I was there, which was about exactly a year ago, I had so many plans. And then on the last day, I was just so wore out. I was just like, I can't see any more people. I need to go on a date by myself. And I went to the Museum of Modern Art. I just walked to the Museum of Modern Art, and I was just like, you know what? I'm going to go here, and if I hate it and leave in 30 minutes, which I probably will, don't worry about it. Just walk in. I was in there for 4 hours, and just it was the best date I've ever taken myself on in my life without the orgasm.
MoMA is awesome.
Yeah.
And it's laid out so well. Like, unlike the Met, you know where the bathrooms are. They're always by the stairs or by the escalators.
Yes. Exactly. I know. The idea about like beauty like that and knowing where the bathrooms are. The other place where bathrooms should always be are bookstores and record stores. Because for some odd reason, walking into those places like relaxes my body so much, my bladder goes, and now I need to evacuate. I'm like, are you kidding? We just did, dude. And this isn't like a old people thing. This is me when I was 16. I'd go to a record store, and all of a sudden that relaxation would just be like, oh, I gotta pee, but I gotta flip through this vinyl.
Oh my gosh. What is your favorite band?
Well, if I have one, I gotta say Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Oh.
Yeah. He's the one that I've seen the most in every incarnation. Except for the latest tours, I haven't seen the Bad Seeds themselves in over a decade because I don't want to go to a stadium. But yeah, the everything else. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what happened? Like, how come Nick Cave is like playing stadium now? Like, how did he, like,
he crossed over? I don't know. Like, and it kind of upsets me because I've lost my intimate Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds shows. But at the same time, like, he's the guy that utterly deserves it. I think he's the one that should be in stadiums over so many other people. Taylor Swift. What about you? Where do you sway on?
Wow. You know, I would have to say, you know, when I was younger, definitely who's good, like 24/7. But what I've been listening to the most in the last 20 years is probably Swerve Driver.
Really? Okay.
Adam Franklin.
Yeah.
His Bolts of Melodies project and stuff.
Well, I don't think I know anything by them. I am going to write that down because... Wow. I have absolute faith in your taste in music after this conversation, my friend. So whatever you say is good. I'm assuming.
I heavily suggest starting with the album Ejector Seat Reservation.
Okay.
You know, they they are like one of these cursed bands. In their earlier incarnation, everything that could go wrong went wrong. They went on their first major tour. And their drummer wigged out like at the Canadian border and like ran away. And they didn't find him for years.
I don't know.
And then Ejector Seat Reservation, their third album, they were signed to Creation. And the day it was issued, Creation deleted it from their catalog because they were in the process of going bankrupt. So they put out this incredible album and almost nobody heard it.
Wow.
But, you know, it's the great thing about the internet is that everything lives digitally. So, you know, it's there on the streams and everything. So check it out.
How do you feel about that? Because it's beautiful that everything is there digitally. But I also feel like we were very lucky that we had to seek things out in major ways. Where we would have to put money out, even if we didn't know if we liked the songs, but we heard of a friend who was cool who liked the album, so we better get it if we want to be cool. And that was kind of how we Spotify'd. I mean, how do you feel about what we had, which was to search and really dig, and then now it kind of is thrown at us if we weren't a part of that.
I mean, you really had to search like through the record racks, going through the 7 inches. And it's like, man, never heard of this band, but you know, Ian Burgess produced Naked Raygun and he's done a great job. Maybe these guys are really good too.
Yeah.
You know, I think he produced like stuff from like the Venus Beads, stuff on like Vinyl Solution. For a while, they were kind of like doing like the UK version of like Naked Raygun, which is kind of funny because Naked Raygun was kind of like the US version of the early Buzzcocks.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I remember.
So we had that dynamic going on.
Yeah. Did you ever subscribe to the Sub Pop Singles of the Month Club?
You know, I didn't because it's not cool to subscribe to anything.
Oh, well.
there was a store in Pier, out in Hoboken called Pure Platters, and they would get all the singles.
Yeah,
and I remember seeing Nirvana's first single. It was Love Buzz, but it was $8, and I was like, "That's outrageous, man! That's exploitative. I'm not buying that." And like, you know, that's like a $2,000 single.
Man. Yeah. I've done that way too many times. What was I forgot. I was just thinking of a single you were talking about. I lost it. I lost the thought, which means
it wasn't a Sub Pop single, was it?
I don't know, but I mean that's how I've heard about Tad. Like I knew about Tad before I knew about Nirvana. So if Tad came around, that big dude, I would love to go see a Tad show. And then it's like, oh, who are these little fellas?
See, I already knew about them because I already had Bleach. Bleach was highlighted at Peter Platter's, and like the first printing was on white vinyl. You know, Bleach
Vinyl. Yeah.
And I thought it was a great record. I thought it was great. And I already knew Tad from, because they were on the compilation called Sub Pop 200.
Oh, I remember that.
Nirvana had a track on there. Yeah. Like a triple record box set.
Yes. Yeah. That opened me up to so many bands. Because I was doing college radio at the time in the Bay Area. So I was. That was my reference, and then I would go see what else we had in the catalog and the stacks. Yeah,
it's funny because Soundgarden was already getting pretty huge,
and they were on that too. That's right.
Yeah, they were on that Sub Pop Rock City. Oh wait, if I sing, do you have to pay royalties?
Maybe. Who knows? Actually, my friend, your singing's not that good, so don't worry about it. Oh, that's fantastic. But we envy each other from across the continental United States. And then even in Los Angeles, like I wish I was in Los Angeles when I was in San Francisco, because now I'm in Los Angeles and I'm around all these people who are just like, you know, friends with these bands where I was just like, oh my God, we used to like wish we were down there. You know, it's like, oh yeah, we're friends with Henry Rollins. I'm like, how did you, what? Huh? He was our god when like Loose Nut came out. I remember when we had the Loose Nut Black Flag cassette, and it was just like, what is this demonism? We need to listen to this again.
Loose Nut, no bolt fits.
Yeah.
But then that was rhymed with, my head is giving me fits.
Yeah. Oh man, there's so many great songs on that. I'm trying to remember.
I really admire Black Flag so much because each album that came out was like so different. Like they were going almost like this dirgy kind of jazz thing, and all their fans were just so confused after each release, you know.
Yeah.
But I remember reading this interview, and Henry Rollins is like, if you love and respect your audience, you don't keep giving them the same thing, what they expect. And it would have been so easy to do like Damaged again and again in like different iterations. But they were doing something. Each release was like, whoa, what is this?
Yeah, yeah. And I even like what he went off and started doing with the Rollins band. They that was just, it was beautiful stuff. Yeah. Man, so when did you start? So you started writing when you were a journalist, and when did you go, wait a second, I have a novel? Like, what was your first novel, and did you think it would get done so much faster than it actually got done and out?
Well, you know, I've wanted to write ever since I learned how to write, like in elementary school. I knew I wanted to write books.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I knew I would get there somehow. And you know, they always say that an author's first public book is probably the second or third book that they wrote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's definitely true for me.
Yeah.
My teacher was right in the sense that after a day of work, like, you don't feel like writing.
Right.
Especially, like, if you're reporting and stuff. But you know, I just thought about it. I'm like, I don't want to spend, you know, all this time on plan B when I haven't really tried plan A. And I just forced myself. It's like, you know what? If you love writing, if you really, really, really want to write a book, you will find a way to do it. And so I just forced myself, like, at nights, on the weekends. And, you know, the first book I wrote, absolutely horrible. It's like on the hard drive somewhere. I hope nobody ever finds it. I hope it's gone. Yeah. But the second book draft that I finished was Waylaid, was what became Waylaid. And I would send it out to these agents, and they were like, "Man, are you out of your mind?" You know, like this is in the 90s, and it was also when I thought that you needed an agent in order to get something published. But I went to this panel discussion at the Asian American Writers Workshop in New York City, and this panel was called "How to Get Your Book Published," and they had a couple of people with major presses, and it included Sun Young Lee, who's the editor of Kaya Press, a very small Asian American press. And at the end of the panel, I went up to Sun Young, and I told her, I was like, "Hey, I wrote this crazy book. Do you want to read this thing?" And she's like, "Yeah." And like it's based on my childhood. We had a really crappy hotel on the coast of New Jersey, and like I worked there from like the age of like 8 to like 16, and you know, all kinds of crazy things happened there. You know, a lot of that went into the book. I just like kind of poured my heart out into this. Like, oh my God, I'm turning 30. I'm gonna die soon. I gotta get this out now. You know, like 30s. Like, oh no, it's all over. You know. So I sent it to Sonya, and she mailed it back like 2 weeks later, and it's like all marked up in red, like all stuff crossed out. And I was like, oh God, and like I just threw it into the desk. And then, like another week or two later, she calls me and she says, "Hey, what do you think?" And I was like, "What do you mean? What do I think? I mean, you hate my book." And she goes, "No, we love it. We want to publish it." I was like, "Oh my God, really?" So, you know, being able to accept that people are trying to help you, even if it hurts a little bit, you know, is one thing that. You know, you cannot have an ego and write a book. You know, you cannot go through the editorial process. You have to accept that, like, your feelings don't matter if something doesn't make sense to somebody. It makes sense in your head, but it may not make sense on the page to somebody else. So, you know, just getting my ego crushed early on was good. And, you know, I had relatively easy time getting a book published. I know people go for years and years, decades and decades of like rejection and everything, but I didn't have that. I was kind of spared that
At the same time,
because I'm a good person.
yeah, exactly. No, but at the same time, you wrote a book that never got published, which I think all of us do. It's like, how do you learn to write a novel? You write a novel. You write like the worst novel that ever
Oh,
should never get out there. You write the novel, and then you realize it that it's bad, and you go, you know what? Let me try this again. Let me work all these hours again. Let me delusionally think I can do this. And then after you put in all that work, there is a that people think it's hard to get published, but I just had a student this last week in my library workshop, and I gave him a lecture he wasn't expecting, because he told me he wants to be a screenwriter, and he said, "Hey, I got a question for you." I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "I got the log line down, and I got the synopsis like ready. So how do I sell this?" And I said, "You don't." I'm like, "Are you kidding?" I was like, "Have you ever written a screenplay?" And he's like, "No, but this is like a great idea." And I'm like, "Here's the thing. Don't talk. If you got a meeting with like Spielberg right now, don't tell him that, because you do not want him to know you for that guy who he, oh yeah, because he's like, I don't have, he said this, which really pissed me off. I don't have time to write it." And I'm like, and that right there is, you have to make time. You're gonna have to hurt for 1 or 2 years at least to get a decent draft. Then once you have that, then all of a sudden you've opened the doors for a possible yes. So a lot of people think it's hard to get published because they don't want to put in the work that maybe they put their whole heart and soul into for a few years, and then it may never come out. Like, there's a good chance nothing comes of it, but when you have a manuscript in your hand that wonderful editor redlined for you, and you thought that that was an insult. But now we know if someone redlined something, that they are actually care. That's like one of the biggest. Yes. That's like, oh my God, thank you. You took the time not only to read it, but to try to make it better. It's like we learned that the hard way.
Yeah, they are not out to hurt you. That's what reviewers do.
Yes, reviewers, reviewers, and readers who might be an ex-girlfriend, maybe, kind of sounds like it. This guy again, he's trash.
So, you know, I was talking about this with my wife, and I was like, you know, entertainment for us is like something else that somebody went through hell to do. Like, someone went through hell to, like, get this movie done, get this TV show done, get this play done, you know? Like, that was someone's, like, trauma for years, probably. And we're just sitting there, like, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo.
Yeah. And that continues to fascinate me, because the audience is supposed to go do do do. It's like they don't owe us anything. we're just lucky they showed up.
yeah.
At the same time, this week was a heavy week in my library workshop, but I was talking to them about how I was like, how many of you have had a novel change your life? And like most people raise their hands, and I'm like, let me tell you something.
Wow.
When you're the author of a novel, that changes your life times 100, because it changes us as writers. And then you get about eight hours with it. And if it affects you in a way that changes you, that's beautiful. And I'm a person that gets changed with novels, but I'll never have the same amount of change as working 3 to 4 years on a novel than on the creative side. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Like, do you feel like as an author, do you feel like your books change you in a certain way?
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
You could disagree. You could say no.
No, I mean, I mean, I feel like I'm changing anyway, but, you know, writing the books is definitely changing, because, it's true for me that every character in the book is me, like some other iteration of me. And so just being able to think about things from all the different points of view is, you know, it's one thing to write it and then have some idea about it, but then, you know, through the drafts, you're like, okay, is this really what this person would think? Like, maybe this would be a little softer, maybe this would be a little harder or something. One of the books in the series is written in the third person, and that really changed me a lot. I was really influenced by reading a whole bunch of books by James T. Farrell. He's probably best known now for writing the Studs Monaghan trilogy. Hmm. But, you know, back in the 40s, he was like one of the most well-read American authors. His world was that of Irish Americans and recent Irish emigres, and the different kind of worlds and how they intersected. It's so rich, and I just love his language and the way that he makes his characters go through hell.
Yeah.
But his books are written in the third person, and so that really pushed me to write one of my books in the third person, because he did all these cool things that I couldn't do in the first person.
That's it. What's his name again? I didn't catch that. I'm sorry.
Oh, James T. Farrell.
Okay.
Two R's and two L's. If you don't read anything else by him, read the Studs Lonergan trilogy.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'm always looking for... I always love finding little deep cuts. I mean, that's probably not a deep cut. That's probably a deep knowledge gap on my part. But to me, it's a deep cut.
The Library of America has put it out.
Mm. And so would you... Now that you've written third person, are you working on something now? And do you feel like you'll go back to third person? Or does first person kind of come a little more naturally to you?
Well, you know, I'm always working on something. I'm always working on the next Taiwan book and another book. The way the way I work is that I always have like two manuscripts at the same time, and
Wow.
sometimes the secondary manuscript becomes a book. One of them was this YA book called David Tong Can't Have a Girlfriend Until He Gets Into an Ivy League College. And Kaya published that in 2020. But it just helps me. I feel like I'm able, it's like carrying like two bags back for the grocery, just to
Yes.
balance it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people would think that would be hard to do, but like even re like I read like five books I'm at different places on five different books at a time, and it's just
Yeah.
and people think that I'm like, oh, wouldn't you get confused? I'm like, it's like watching TV. I mean, you could remember the episodes and the characters and come back to it a week later. It's not,
Yeah.
but these days with people with short attention spans don't understand that because they're
Oh.
already on the next TikTok, which a 30-second anything is too much.
Yeah. Or they binge the whole thing. It's like, jeez.
Oh, and I'm guilty of that too. I'm guilty, and I'm kind of like I think I've told myself I need to stop binging on series that are great. Even though they're great, they're drugs. They're taking me away from other things I need to do, like sleep.
They are. I try not to watch series until they're done, so then I can watch the whole thing. I broke my collarbone 2 years ago, and I was laid up after having surgery, and so I was like, I'm just gonna watch all of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul because, I'm ready now. I'm not going anywhere.
And what did
Yeah,
you
it's
think?
great.
Like, what did you think going from front to back on both of those series in one shot?
Breaking Bad gets all the attention, but I think Better Call Saul is a better show. It definitely hits a lot more notes, really unexpected areas,
And then now he's got
Yeah.
Pluribus out with the woman lawyer as the lead.
Oh,
And that
okay.
show is completely different and so
Oh.
amazing. He does no wrong, but Better Call Saul, I don't think Better Call Saul gets the beauty of that craft unless they prove themselves on Breaking Bad. And then plus Bob Odenkirk, he's a comedian, but he plays he's always a comedian from tragedy almost, and that's why he's just beautiful.
The poor anonymous guy working at Cinnabon.
Yeah, exactly. And isn't that beautiful? Because it's just like, how are we going to get there? How was it talk about let's show the end before we start this 5 years. And that what a beautiful way to make a question for to remind us. Oh yeah, we're going to get here. And so we keep watching because we're like, how do you get there? It's the question. It's hard drugs, man. It's hard drugs. It's an addiction.
Does meth count?
The meth. I'm either gonna do meth or I'm gonna binge watch and then just like, I don't know, man. You might get a lot of stuff done on meth. You might get a book
Don't
out.
try this at home, kids.
This is not a public service announcement. The book is called "The Dead Can't Wait." The Dead Can't Make a Living. His name is Ed Lin. Ed, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Tony.
You are listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCRLP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.